Hello and welcome to Turkey Book Talk. I'm William Armstrong speaking to you from here in Istanbul. In this podcast, we hear from authors of newly released books on Turkey and its region. Subscribe through iTunes, Podbean, Stitcher or Acast. Like the Facebook page, follow the Twitter account at Turkey Book Talk. Check out show notes and other links at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com and rate or review the podcast wherever you listen to it. Once again, if you haven't already, do consider joining Turkey Book Talk as a member. Membership gives you various extra benefits and content, and it also helps keep the podcast going. If you sign up as a paying member, you get access to full transcripts in both Turkish and English of every interview published on Turkey Book Talk in PDF form as soon as the episode is published. You'll also receive transcripts of the entire Turkey Book Talk archive in English, which amounts to over 60 conversations so far. Most of these transcripts were previously published at the Hurriyet Daily News, but from now on, a Turkey Book Talk membership is the only way to access them. The archive also includes a number of interviews not previously published on the podcast. As a member, you will also get access to a special 30% discount on Turkey and Ottoman history books published by IB Taurus. IB Taurus have a fantastic archive of titles, and they've made over 200 books from their Turkey Ottoman history series, both academic and more general interest, available at cut price, exclusive to Turkey Book Talk members through a special discount code. A number of IB Taurus authors have featured on the podcast in the past, and there will be more in the future, so becoming a member is obviously a great way to get more acquainted with their work. If you do end up becoming a member, you'll be helping us develop the podcast, and if more members sign up, we may end up being able to start publishing a new episode every week, up from the current one episode every 2 weeks. To become a Turkey Book Talk member, all you have to do is pledge a minimum of $3 per episode via Turkey Book Talk's official Patreon account. At present, we post new episodes bi-weekly, so the monthly membership price is no more than $6. If we end up becoming able to publish a new episode every week, then that will go up to $12 monthly maximum, which is not too bad a deal, I dare say. Of course, if you're feeling particularly generous and want to pledge more, then everything helps and you'll certainly be more than welcome. But so long as you pledge $3 or above per episode, membership is entirely at your own discretion. Members are only charged when a new episode is published, so there are no prior commitments or strings attached. You'll be free to sign off whenever you want. So do consider taking advantage of this new membership system. You can find details of how to sign up via armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com or through any of the other Turkey Book Talk pages which have links to the Patreon account. But now let's get on with our latest episode, and in it we welcome Asla Aydın Taşbaş. She's a journalist and fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and recently penned a long report called The Discreet Charm of Hypocrisy, an EU-Turkey Power Audit. The report is based on interviews with top officials on all sides, and obviously comes at a time of very rocky relations between Brussels and Ankara, described by Aydın Taşbaş as a kind of low-level turf war. The report gives a good opportunity to reflect on Turkey's long dance with the EU, where things have gone wrong along the way, and how things could go forward. I started by asking Asla Aydın Taşbaş to tell us what the aim of the report was.
I have been a little bit reluctant to start this project, even though we had 28 terrific researchers in these countries, partly because initially it felt too much like political science. And I come from journalism, so I like to do interviews and long interviews and write about more timely topics. But when the research came in, I was like, wow, this is really interesting. There's a lot of really interesting details in it, basically showing the differences among European member states on attitudes about Turkey. So I was already looking through this research, trying to come up with themes and trying to understand various sort of commonalities, contradictions among member states. And then Erdogan visited France in January, on January 5th. And this was very important because it was the first time after long hiatus that he'd been invited to a major Western European capital, because there was an undeclared sort of policy of not inviting Erdogan on official visits for the past 2 years. So the visit to Paris with Macron, and I was watching Erdogan's press conference with Macron, and all of a sudden the French president was talking about hypocrisy. And he said, to be very specific, we must get out of the hypocrisy that consists in thinking that there's a natural progression of opening chapters in the accession process. This is not true. And I was flabbergasted. There was my theme, because because all along we knew that Turkey's accession process to Europe, for the past few years at least, had become a huge hypocrisy. Certainly wasn't one when it started a decade ago, more than a decade ago, and Turkey was carrying out reforms and Europeans were enthusiastic, some less than others, but Turkey was enthusiastic and things were moving forward. But then there came the long lull, so to speak. From 2010 on, there really wasn't much progress. But everyone decided, both sides, both the European Commission and Turkey, both Europe and Turkey, decided to keep it on, like sort of this pretension game. You know, there is an accession process, knowing that it's not evolving into anything, knowing that it's no longer having a transformative impact in Turkey, knowing that, you know, Europeans have no intention, etc., etc. So it became this exercise in hypocrisy. And usually, journalists who cover Turkey's accession process kind of think of it as a joke among themselves. But this here was for the first time, a major head of state, in this case, Emmanuel Macron, coming out and saying, wait a minute, this is a hypocrisy. And hence was my title. It's a report called The Discreet Charm of Hypocrisy. And essentially, this is trying to understand this very complicated relationship, peeling different layers, trying to see where hypocrisy works and where it doesn't work. And my conclusion in the end is that there's a limit to the use of hypocrisy. We are at a stage where it's no longer working for either side. I mean, we can keep the process going and pretending that Turkey is moving towards Europe, but in reality, what we really need to do for both sides is to think of new ways of engagement. Turkey and Europe do need one another, do need to be engaged, do need to be strategically aligned, but maybe the accession process is no longer providing that framework.
And the report comes at a pretty, it comes at a time when relations between Turkey and the EU are very tense over a lot of different issues, really, kind of trench warfare you mentioned in the report. But also, it strikes me that these relations are also a kind of very tired subject now as well, because, you know, remember back in the day, you know, 10 years ago, the kind of release of a new EU progress report on Turkey, for example, was like a huge news story, and it made the headlines and it led the news. And now when they come out, as one is due to come out soon, really, people just shrug their shoulders. And as you mentioned there, it's they kind of recognize the kind of hypocrisy at the center of this process on both sides. So now it's really just kind of an opportunity for Burhan Kuzu to go on TV and just rip it up and throw it in the bin. It's really a big shift from the situation 10 years ago when it was leading the news.
And that goes for both sides. I mean, also Europeans have recently declared their plans for enlargement in the Balkans, and conspicuously Turkey is not in the mix, although it started the process earlier than some Balkan countries. But yes, I mean, I think officials do recognize privately that it's not going anywhere. The question is, what do both sides want from this? I mean, why are we in this? I think we have to go back and remember why we were in this in the first place. And then if the accession process is not providing that framework, then maybe what else? And I see quite a reduced appetite to talk about Turkey in Brussels. And similarly here, it's, as you mentioned, a non-item, basically. Progress report is due soon, and it's going to be another occasion for Burhan Kuzu. To the extent that someone asks him about that, I don't think anyone will find the topic worthy of a television discussion anymore. But it's going to be an opportunity for Burhan Kuzu to trash the report. I don't even think it makes it to the front page anymore. So where do we go from here? What is a new relationship? Can this be revived? It's very discredited, the process as it is. It can certainly be revived as the accession process, but I see no inclination in Ankara at this point to return to the kind of rule of law structure that Copenhagen criteria demands. At least we're seeing no indications that there is an interest to return back to the reform process that became the hallmark of AKP's early years. So I think that there is a real heart-to-heart discussion instead of this passive-aggressive positioning that both sides seem to have, in which we keep it as it is, but we're going to keep taking this pot shot at each other, and Europeans will whisper that, you know, don't worry about it, nothing will happen with Turkey, we'll keep gradually cutting off funds, and then meanwhile Turks will, you know, sort of publicly trash Europe Europe at every opportunity. I mean, for what? So that these are some of the thoughts that are in this research. But in essence, what it is looking deeper into the perceptions in these countries and trying to come up with ways that this sort of need for strategic alignment can be met.
And I want to talk a bit later about some of the kind of diagnoses that you make and some of the proposals. But one of the important things I think you note in the report as well is that there's this big divide in kind of elite establishment opinion in Europe on relations with Turkey and the accession process and popular public opinion. Could you just talk a bit about that divide?
Yes. Remember that this research is essentially a research of the elite. We went to the establishment in 28 member states, and what we found is very much what's in the title, some type of hypocrisy. At times, officials telling us, yes, it is hypocrisy, but hypocrisy, there's a room for hypocrisy in diplomacy. And what it is on paper, a large chunk of the European Union member states support the accession process. 22 countries believe Turkey is a strategically important partner and would make the EU stronger. But on the other hand, they also don't want the accession process to move forward. Things like opening new chapters have no support. Instead, quite the other way, they would like the accession process frozen as it is. But no one other than Austria wants to terminate or suspend the accession process. So they, in a sense, everyone is drawn to the status quo, which is this limbo. And when asked why Turkey is not fit to move forward, in all the major players, they talk, you know, there's talk about Copenhagen criteria. Turkey is well below Copenhagen criteria, human rights issue, you know, sort of the crackdown since the coup, etc. But then when you ask officials if they think their country should bring up Turkey's human rights issue more, Copenhagen criteria and whatnot, the answer is almost always no. So there is this sort of attachment to a status quo, which essentially describes no movement and a limbo, and it's not even strategic ambiguity. It's sort of strategic hatred on both sides at this point, because this has become such a love and hate relationship. And I think that, you know, the elites in most countries, and certainly in all the major European players, have recognized the fact that while they support the accession process as an idea, their public doesn't. And hence, you know, it's no wonder that Turkey and European member states like Netherlands, like Germany, even to an extent France, end up having these spike in tensions with Turkey during elections, because that's when the elites have to cater to the public. And then when the elections are over, they go back to the sort of same format. Where were we? Let's go back to the status quo. And I am essentially saying, look, this is not sustainable, nor is it useful to anybody. Let's think of new ways. Let's also not disregard public sentiments. But since Turkey does not seem to have an apparent desire to go back to the Copenhagen criteria or rule of law at this point, maybe we need to think of a new set of ideas for the interim period. I'm not calling for a termination or suspension of the accession process. Sure, let's keep it as it is for the next generation, generations of Turks who may end up returning to, maybe it's going to be a few years, maybe 10 years, maybe 20 years, there will be someone, although it's hard to imagine accession process continuing as in its current format for 20 years, but no need to terminate it at this point. It's just not enough in terms of creating a bridge. And also a message to Ankara. It's very clear that the people that Ankara frequently attacks in Europe, frequently criticize, gets into sort of verbal fights with, that is to say, the government officials, politicians, and the elites, are the very people that support Turkey's accession process. Turkey's best advocates in Europe are these establishment figures. Because if you go to the public, they're not really keen on Turkey's membership at all.
Also linked to this broader question is like the sense that Turkey and Europe have kind of drifted apart in recent years. But at the same time, that's happened, or one of the simultaneous processes that has been going on is that in Europe itself, there's been this kind of drift. And we're speaking just a day after the Hungarian election, where people are talking about like, the binning of norms that people used to associate directly with the European Union. And it seems like those things are now drifting apart as well. And there's a kind of sense of strategic, not decay, but drift that people can't really appreciate what Europe's for anymore. So in a way, it feels kind of inevitable that when that's the situation in Europe as well, the relations with Turkey are also going to go through a rocky patch.
Sure, but Turkey itself is regressing. I mean, we politely call it democratic backsliding. So in any case, there is, as you mentioned, an anxiety in Europe about the future of the liberal order. People, sort of European values and the very idea of Europe as became the basis of the European Union after the Second World War is now in jeopardy. The populist nativist rebellion in various major European member states, countries, not to mention the sort of situation, global situation, and Trump had been rising Russia, rising China, and a chaos in the Middle East. So Europeans very much have dropped notions of transformative power. They no longer seem to have faith in Europe's transformative power outside its borders. Remember, a decade ago, you had discussions about concepts like neighborhood policy, European neighborhood. It wasn't just Turkey. The idea was the Balkans and all these countries on the fringes would eventually benefit from Europe's democratic sort of osmosis of some sort would happen around the borders. And first of all, there's a lot of anxiety in Europe about the future of their own liberal order because of internal reasons. And secondly, no faith in Europe's ability to have a transformative impact. I remember 2005, I think, the night in Brussels when Turkey started negotiations. We'd gone there en masse. Hundreds of Turkish journalists had descended upon Brussels, and it was really a historic moment, a big strategic choice by Turkey and Europe. But, things look very different now. Things look very different in Turkey. Let's face it, doesn't really have that much of an appetite to pursue membership to the European Union, not only in terms of reforms and, returning to rule of law and Copenhagen criteria. I think that when you listen to Turkish officials here, and you can really only get a sense of this here in living in Turkey, but you get the sense that they're really angling for a different role as a regional hegemon, sort of a regional power with links to Europe, but not necessarily a member of the club. So two things, Europe's anxiety about Turkey and about anything beyond its borders, and Turkey's desire to become more of an independent power are happening simultaneously, I think.
And there's a sense, really, that we do have this kind of populist wave. Turkey has its version of it, but it's happening in Europe as well. And in that sense, it really does feel like a very long time ago when you talk about 2005 there. It's like another world. But even then, there were kind of doubts, also practical problems with the Cyprus issue, which is a very boring subject, really. But it's one that has actually proved very important in being a massive hurdle to the accession process and also an excuse to not move it forward. But there was a quote that you make, that you quote in the report, I think. And it was a former EU commissioner who once said, and this was a long time, this was like over 10 years ago, he said that Turkey can't join the European Union because it's too big, too poor, and too Muslim. And and at a time when these populist waves are sweeping across the continent, it seems, the fact is that if Turkey was let in at the moment, you do wonder whether it would just risk further stoking the flames of anti-EU populism in many places. You get the sense that in Brussels, they think it could be a kind of fatal step, even though however distant it seems at the moment.
Well, already, even though the accession process is effectively frozen, you have seen in Brexit how prominently Turkey came up. Turks are coming was one of the themes used by the Leave campaign. And then in the German elections also, it played a huge role by two parties, the Social Democrats and the Christian Democrats. Both of them essentially support the idea of continuing with the accession process. But if you remember the debate between the two leaders, basically opposition leader and Merkel. Now, much of the debate, the final television debate, was about Turkey, both sides accusing each other of being too lenient on Turkey. Similarly, you had a big Turkey debate in the Netherlands. Turkey is a big domestic issue now. And I think that it's also, Europe is also a big domestic issue here. And we've seen how bashing Europe is a very much part of the Yes campaign and the April 2017 referendum. And I think that this is not really giving us much hope about a popular support for the idea. The elites are admitting that their public is very much against this. So this is an elite game in many ways. But the elites are realizing that it's difficult to sustain this game.
You mentioned Brexit there, and even before that vote, I mean, Brexit is itself an extremely depressing subject, really. But even before that Brexit referendum, there were voices coming out saying Britain and Turkey that are both there on the other opposite sides of Europe, and they're both kind of historically not really at the core of Europe. So it could be some formula going forward in the years ahead, you know, that they can both kind of craft kind of bespoke relationships with Europe, not being really in the central core of the European Union, but somehow being key partners and economically very well integrated. I don't know, it seems like if you're going to craft idealistically from the outside the ideal relationship between Turkey and the European Union and Britain and the European Union, it'd be very easy to do, because you could kind of draw, you could make a nice historical case for why the two should have a close but not central relationship. But actually getting to that point with minimum accidents is very difficult indeed. And at the moment, these relations are very depressing, because it's just about people just shouting at each other and getting angry with each other and using the other side for domestic political purposes, and it just makes things worse and worse, it seems.
Exactly. Some people in Ankara are starting to think that customs union upgrade, and that is to say modernizing the existing customs union free trade agreement Turkey has with the European Union, may be a way of preserving the economic relationship in the near future. It may be the only way of preserving it. And ironically, that's the model that Britain will end up having if they once they opt out of the European Union. But I think customs union, I found, was a very complicated issue, because Europeans are now increasingly feeling that this is the one last instrument they have as a leverage over Turkey. And negotiations over customs union, I mean, essentially this, you would think this is a technical issue, but because Ankara seems to want it so much, and because the sort of human rights criticism coming from the European Commission seems to not have much of an impact, I think the customs union is now emerging as the focal point of upcoming negotiations. Erdogan has mentioned that they'd like to upgrade it. Other officials, including Turkish foreign minister, have mentioned that they'd like to upgrade it. The reason for Turkey to want to upgrade it so much is because they believe, I think, it would be a signal to financial markets around the world that, you know, Turkey is still integrated with European economy. It would be particularly important for rating agencies, and sort of a little boost at a time that people are feeling extremely vulnerable on the economic front. And for Europe, keeping the idea alive is important, because they too want to trade with Turkey, for starters. It's very important. I mean, this is one of the things we've seen in a lot of countries have admitted that, you know, one of the most important aspects of their relationship with Turkey was trade. And secondly, they feel this is a leverage they have over Turkey. So it's boiling down to financial things. And I have to say, we didn't realize this back in 2015 when the migration deal, we did realize it, I should say, but when the migration deal was finally agreed upon, you know, people have said, oh, great, you know, lots of applaud on both sides. But essentially, it defined the future of relations between Turkey and Europe as a transactional deal. So it seemed to have some connection to the accession process, and that was largely because Turkish Prime Minister at the time, Ahmet Davutoğlu, was really pushing to sort of use this as an opportunity to revitalize the accession process. But with him gone, I mean, there isn't much support or push in Ankara, and basically transactional is what it is. A migration deal has come to define the future of our relations. It's still on the table, but I think the rest is increasingly taking on that formula of give and take.
And that's the thing, really. You know, when politics has become so toxic between the two sides, the kind of one thing that everybody always refers to that prevents a complete break between the two sides is this economic relationship, which remains very important for both sides. You know, Turkey is still very much dependent, really, on trade with Europe. I think 50% of its trade is still with European Union member countries. It's still also very dependent on inward investment. And perhaps for the time being, you know, the key thing really preventing a complete breakup and keeping everybody together really in this loveless marriage is this economic relationship.
That I agree with that. That's the case. And I think that there's also, you know, below the radar screen, there's also a strong counter-terrorism relationship, particularly with countries like France, the Netherlands, and Germany. And I'm talking about jihadists in Syria, since Turkey is essentially a front country in terms of the war against ISIS. I've realized during this research that it matters a lot. That's sort of not something that we think of when we think of the accession process, but at the moment, the counter-terrorism relationship matters a lot, precisely because Europeans feel they are under attack and have suffered, and Turkey's contribution is important. But again, that too is a transactional deal. It's a give and take. And I have to say, you know, when I discussed this report with some European officials, representative of some European countries in Ankara, that is to say, diplomats, several were very interested. One or two of them have said that they feel, what about the human rights dialogue? One of the things they brought up, it was like, look, if we switch to something beyond the accession process, there will be no room for the human rights discussion. And my response was, do you really think there's a human rights discussion now? It does not seem to me at all that it's a priority for the Commission in Brussels. We're not getting a European, major European power or leader or European commissioner or some sort of an official talking about the human rights in Turkey every day. It's pretty quiet, and there's very little, and Europe has very little leverage. So it's nice to think of accession process as sort of an instrument to improve the human rights situation and rule of law in Turkey, but I really don't think that's the case. So how do we improve human rights? What can Europe do about the sort of rule of law situation in Turkey? I have to say that, you know, first thing they can do is stop patting themselves in the back, in the sense that Europeans haven't done much lately, haven't been doing much for the past couple of years. I mean, yes, they do attend a trial here and there, but that's about it. So we have to stop pretending that, you know, there's a big human rights and democracy transformative impact, that Europe has this big transformative impact on these two situations. In fact, they've been pretty quiet on the human rights scene. And secondly, if you look at the numbers, European aid, European Union aid going to Turkey, it's something like 800 million euros a year, and only 30 million of it goes to civil society in Turkey. So we kind of think of all these civil society organizations thriving and NGOs and human rights, but there's so little. There's so little of it actually going into civil society in Turkey. With the rest, much of the rest goes into things like, you know, government programs and municipal sewage networks, pavements, and this ministry, that ministry. So it's mainly support for official networks. I'm not talking about the $3 billion that's given for refugee aid. This is sort of the IPA funds, the pre-accession funds that have been going into Turkey since the start of accession negotiations. So if it were the case that Turkish civil society was thriving because of funding from the European Union, and that Europeans were giving Turkey essentially a hard time about human rights, or able to come here and make a difference, I would think twice about suggesting alternatives. But it's really not the case at all. I don't want, you know, EU member states to come away thinking they are doing anything about human rights. I mean, improvement to the extent that it happens is essentially because Turkish civil society itself, the one institution that does make a difference, and and I've singled that out in my report, and I think it's very important, is Council of Europe. Council of Europe, so not the EU, not Brussels, not the Commission, but the Council of Europe has been, Turkey is a founding member of the Council of Europe, and essentially it was very important in steering Turkey back to parliamentary democracy after the coup in 1980. And I think it can play a similarly significant role in the near term. It was instrumental in after the coup in getting Turkish president to shelve his idea of reinstituting the death penalty. It wasn't the EU saying don't do it. It was the Council of Europe and Yagland, the Secretary General of the Council of Europe, coming to Ankara, staying and for long meetings, 4.5 hours. And I think that we should really think of the Council as one of the institutions that can play a larger role in the future of Turkey. And I think that cooperation is very unexplored. There's more that needs to be done there.
The other thing is, like I referred a bit before to the idea that, economic relations will kind of inevitably prevent a complete break. But it's always a bit tempting to be so deterministic. You know, before the First World War, of course, people said that there was no chance of a war just because it was in no one's economic interest and everyone was so closely connected and whatnot. I'm not saying that war's going to break out between Turkey and the EU, but, it's easy to kind of be seduced by that idea that economics defines everything. There are other aspects at play. Of course.
Well, Europeans are traders. Germans are, the Italians are, the Spanish are, and they really do, again, based on this history, they really want to carry on the economic relationship with Turkey. That is also obvious. They don't necessarily want Turkey in the club, but they want Turkey aligned with the club. So it's not just Turkey receives investments from Europe. But you've touched upon a very important point. I mean, the new alignment, global alignment, the talk of war impending, there is more and more talk of that, obviously, are part of the world in the Middle East, but not just in the Middle East. People from Washington to Brussels to basically other, India, there is a lot of question marks about new world powers and what it means, and Russia flexing its muscles and the sort of Russia-Iran alliance versus US Saudis. And where is Turkey going to be in this? For the past, 70 years, let's say, Turkey has been squarely in the Western camp. Is there going to be a Western camp from now on? And is Turkey necessarily going to want to be in that camp? All of these things are going to be really define some of the struggles that we're going to see over the next decade.
That was Asla Aydın Taşbaş. Many thanks to her. You can find a link to the report that we were discussing over at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com. Remember, do consider joining the Turkey Book Talk membership system. The deal is not bad value at all. If you pledge a minimum $3 per episode, you'll get access to transcripts in English and Turkish of every episode as it's published, as well as the entire Turkey Book Talk archive, and also exclusive access to a special 30% discount on a selection of over 200 books on Turkey and Ottoman history, published by IB Taurus. You'll be helping in Turkey Book Talk keep the show on the road, developing further and providing a bigger platform for our guests and their work. And you can find links with information on how to sign up on all the Turkey Book Talk pages. Also, do spare a moment to rate or review Turkey Book Talk on whatever podcast platform you listen on. You can follow via Twitter or like the Facebook page to stay updated with new episodes. And you can send any recommendations, feedback or abuse to williamjohnarmstrong@gmail.com. But until the next episode of Turkey Book Talk in a couple of weeks, thank you very much for listening. Seçtiğim sensin.